right, we are back with episode 506 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host. And tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville. And I think that's a bit of an extreme reaction to people trying to offer you samples.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm glad people finally get the names they deserve.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and honestly, I've been that fed up with salespeople too.
And I'll be right with you guys. I need to go do some carving. It's a compulsion. There's a wall. It's blank right there. I'll be right back. Edmund, if you could give some kind of disclaimer while I'm busy.
Certainly. Whatever it is John is carving or mapping out for us, we will naturally talk about all of the implications and everything that might have happened in the news, in the episodes we'll be covering, and just spoiling you silly. But we all know you've been sitting home over the holidays just catching up on all of these shows, so it won't matter at all.
That's right, that's right. Okay, I'm done. I'm good. I think I know where we're going now. Yeah, we are obviously going to go right into, from here, more of this week's genre news, after which we will be having our break and then going into more episodic discussion, wrapping up our top shows for the week and then delving into the shows that didn't quite make the mark. But let's go ahead and start with the news items, and I believe I will go ahead and... now, you know what? I'm going to kick this one over to Bronstom, the first one here.
No worries. Fans of Breaking Bad have just found out that AMC will be premiering Better Call Saul, the Breaking Bad prequel/spinoff. It'll be premiering on February 8th at 10:09 Central, with the second episode following the next day in the same time slot. For those who have been following the development of the show, Better Call Saul is going to be a prequel to Breaking Bad, based around the character of Saul Goodman, although he's called Jimmy McGill when the series starts, apparently. And it's going to follow sort of how he came to be the criminal lawyer, if you know what I mean, that we know and love from Breaking Bad. The show is going to star Bob Odenkirk and Jonathan Banks, both of whom were in Breaking Bad, as well as Michael McKean, who will play Chuck, who is apparently Saul/Jimmy's brother. And yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I was a bit wary when they first announced it because they were originally looking at making it more like a half-hour comedy sort of spin-off. And if any character from Breaking Bad was going to support that, it was going to be Saul Goodman. But having heard some interviews and some talk and that in the past... 6 months or so from Bob Odenkirk and some other people, it sounds like they've got something a bit more serious and a bit more interesting on their hands than they necessarily expected when they first started developing the show. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, Edmund, were you looking forward to this as well?
Oh, absolutely. And the little teaser trailer that they've been showing on AMC, so it certainly has me both chuckling and intrigued. As Bronson says, they do seem to be going for less of a straight comedy that they were toying with earlier, but certainly obviously compared to the parent show, there is definitely more of a tongue in cheek element, and certainly having people like Bob Odenkirk and Michael McKean around, you know there's going to be some sly humor going on amidst whatever dramatic situations force Jimmy to become Saul.
Yeah, there's no question it's going to be a sort of more lighthearted, more humorous show. It's just as possible to do that without necessarily having it be a comedy. And as well, I'd say to, you know, you look back to the first couple of seasons of Breaking Bad, and it was it did have a much stronger vein of black humor. It was a they played up on the ridiculousness of Walter White and Jesse Pinkman deciding to be meth dealers. Like it was at times it was a bit farcical, and then that made the more dramatic violent moments of the show more impactful. And then as it went on, by the time you get to like season 3 and 4, the comedy has really a lot of the comedic elements sort of like very naturally faded away, and it was a much more serious show. So this is exactly a stretch for Breaking Bad people to make a more comedic show.
Mm. Let's see now. Moving on from there to something that's a little closer to the genre home, so to speak. This one's a little surprising because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that this show, this comic property rather, had once been already adapted and kind of rejected. So I don't know if this is a return to that or not. But at any rate, Global Frequency from Warren Ellis is being given a television adaptation produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. Oh, okay. But it is going to be written by Farscape and Defiance creator Rockne S. O'Bannon. So there is a bit of hope there.
Yeah.
But this is technically, since it's a Vertigo comic property, a DC property. So this is yet another DC concept or comic property that's being developed for television behind so many others. But any thoughts on that? I did not read this particular comic. Gary, are you at all familiar with this one?
Yeah, I've read it, and you're right, John. It had been optioned, and I thought it was optioned as something with one of the cable channels at one point. So I'm a little curious that this is almost seems to be popping up from scratch and isn't actually a continuation of that same thing. However, Bruckheimer has just, I don't know if broken's the right word, or completed or finished or agreed to separate from Disney / Marvel in the past several months. So it's not surprising that he is jumping ship over to a DC property, given that he's just concluded a long-term arrangement with the people at Disney. So. It should be, interesting. There is a lot of, I think Bruckheimer might actually fit, a fair amount of this. There, it was extremely, sort of violent, violent, explosive show, and that sort of sounds right up his alleyway, at least for some of the stuff. So, it sounds promising, and as much as we like to pick on Bruckheimer, this is what he does well. So, we'll have to see.
Yeah, and I've read it as well, and I think as, in addition, I mean the composition of the team is we all know how connected Warren Ellis is on the interwebs and social media, and this series was very much sort of his take on what a super cybercrime unit might consist of with this sort of this list of people with specific skills who are sort of called in depending on the nature of the mission that's needed, and all of course connected through the web, and people who are extremely cyber savvy and hip, and in terms of appeal to and relation to current affairs and current mores, I think it has potential, it would be interesting to see, given how on the edge Warren Ellis's work has been, to see someone actually try and bring it into a TV or movies. But I know this is TV, but yeah, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed on this one.
Hopefully, Scorpion did not ruin it for everybody.
Yes.
Anyway, moving on then to the next piece of news here. Oh boy, here we go. Gary, why don't you take this? Because I know you're a fan of over-padded adaptations.
Oh goodness, yes, the Stand, which terrified me as a teenager, will be coming out in four movies. Now, anyone familiar with this work realizes that there is a significant shift at a certain point in the book, and I could easily see it being broken down into two movies with little trouble, possibly even three, laying heavily on the back half of the book. To stretch this out to four, it's got to drag. I don't see how it can't. It is. It is being. It's put out by Warner Brothers, and they're splitting it. It's being directed by a director named Josh Boone. You might know him from he just directed The Fault in Our Stars, which was recently out. I'm not that familiar with his projects, but I just can't see it being stretched out. And this is a book that is still, I think it's an honest, somewhere around 800 page book. It's not thin, and perhaps they can do justice to it, but I just can't see stretching it to four. Three would be a bit of a stretch for me. Four, I guess we're going to be living in the post-apocalyptical world in cities much longer before we get into the more metaphysical section of the book.
I'm not that familiar anymore with the Stand in terms of how they could possibly break this up more than, like you said, the distinct halves. How about you, Bronstom, Edmund? Either one of you have any ideas on this or thoughts?
Yeah, well,
the Warner Brothers once again dragging something way, way more out than it needs to. Aren't they also behind the trilogy for the chapbook that Rowling put out as Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them? It's now a trilogy when it was like a 40-page promo, but anyway.
Yeah, well, my initial thought was, you know, oh, this is just that whole thing in Hollywood where an idea takes hold and then everything's got to conform to it. And after Twilight and the Hunger Games took trilogies and made four films out of them, they were like, oh, well look, The Stand's a really thick book. We can do four movies on that. I'm just waiting for it to appear on a double bill with the Dark Tower movies.
The Dark Tower makes more sense.
Yes.
Well, there's a bunch of them. You know, that you can see.
Although I was thinking as well in terms of the fact that that project has kept going in and out of development hell. So we'll have to wait and see how far they actually get with this.
I just remember I've seen the miniseries and I've made several attempts to start reading The Stand, and it's not that I didn't enjoy it. It's just that something would randomly come up, and by the time I'd go back to it, I'd completely forgotten everything that had happened. But even just recently, I remember listening to another podcast that did a review of that miniseries and whatnot. And one of the things that kept coming back was that it was the miniseries felt very, very bloated. So why would you make four films out of it? Like, the reason that the miniseries was so long is because Stephen King was writing the damn teleplay, and that's not necessarily a smart thing to make an adaptation so literal and so faithful. I mean, if you're going to sit down and make a movie, even if it was maybe two parts, because I appreciate that The Stand is a really, really long book. But then again, on the flip side, the reason that these other franchises were able to do a two, you know, put one book into two movies was because it was an established franchise already. They know that people are going to go see two, whereas this would be straight off the bat. I think a Stand movie, anything more than one movie is going to be a massive stretch in terms of getting people interested in it. If people go... Only people who are already a fan of the book, or maybe the miniseries, are going to see that The Stand Part 1 is coming to cinemas and think, oh, that sounds good. That sounds worth seeing. That could be interesting. Anyone else, anyone who doesn't really know, you know, the book, the source material or whatnot, is going to be like, huh? Like, why are you assuming that I'm going to be that into seeing two movies? Like, they're going to shoot themselves in the foot if they try and stretch it out that much.
Mm-hmm. That's my thought, too, is that it doesn't give enough time and it doesn't give them enough material to get through in order to hook the audience to keep going.
Well, it's not only that, but just the two halves of the book are really a different thing. You know, the first half, I can see people feeding into fans of The Walking Dead and stuff. It's this sort of post-apocalypse, you know, trying to survive. Now, there's not zombies, of course, but, you know, there's still that thing of, you know, lawlessness and people, you know, not having resources and stuff like that. And that's one type of movie. But when you get to the second half, it becomes such a metaphysical or at least I would have to imagine it would become not just a straight villain role, but this whole greater concept of good and evil, you know, moral drama getting played out, that the people who like the first half of the book might not like the second half at all.
You know, yeah, that was a complaint that I heard in a lot of these things, is that the first part of the book is just the first part of the book is really engaging, and it would be super engaging now that we've just had this we've been having this massive Ebola scare. Even in my neck of the woods, there's been people freaking out about it. And so the first part of the story being this thing about how a disease runs rampant across the planet, like, that's interesting. But yeah, there is such a transition, such a twist in the tale. Thing is, that's where a good screenwriter, that's where a good, solid, pragmatic adaptation is really, really going to help, because you start laying in biblical, that fantastical element of the story. They can start laying that in a lot earlier. So even while we see this disease running rampant, and at first it might seem like it's purely an end of the world through you know, spread of a virus sort of story, it's like you can make that point early. You can soften the blow later when the story transitions and whatnot. And it means that a lot of the time spent later in the book doing the heavy lifting of making that transition doesn't have to be made. It's like you. Again, absolute fidelity to the source material is not necessarily a plus.
Well, especially in this case, because let's face it, one of the things that is the downside or drawback to Stephen King and his writing style is that he just starts with a premise and then he just kind of goes where it takes him until he reaches what he feels is a conclusion. And a lot of works, even this one, as good as many people may think it is, and I'm not disputing that, it's fairly inventive, it smacks of that. He kind of was going in one direction and then went, hey, you know what, I think I'll go this direction. See where this takes me. And yeah, so we'll see where this goes. I have a feeling that this will either get cut down to something more pragmatic or it'll just become an example of how this whole padding out of franchises is getting ridiculous. I think we all kind of have been on the fence a little bit about The Hobbit and whether or not that goes too far, but this may be going even a step beyond that. This may be getting into
The Hobbit has the justification of there is a lot of extra material, a lot of appendices, a lot of like Tolkien's notes and sort of stuff like that that support bigger stories and more stories within the scope of this time frame that they're thinking. But yeah, this is a completely different. This is just taking the one bit of material and stretching it out far more than it needs to be.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ronston, why don't you go ahead and take the next one? This is interesting, to say the least.
Alrighty, just double-checking I've got the right thing open. William Shatner joins Haven cast as a recurring guest star. According to Zaptuit, and this press release has gone out, William Shatner is going to appear in 4 episodes of Haven in the second half of the 5th season. It'll air in 2015. Shatner will play a pivotal character that has the potential to forever impact the fate of the town Haven and its troubled residents. This is one of a few casting things that's announced in this article, but obviously it's a big one. According to these things, apparently the episode that aired that's just about to air as of this recording, or has just aired as of this recording, guest stars another WWE wrestler as an old friend of Dwight, who, as fans of the show are probably aware, is played by, as he's quoted, WWE superstar Edge.
let's not take away from the fact that he actually does a really good job as Dwight.
Oh yeah, no. I always find it funny that he's credited that way. Like just pull a Dwayne Johnson already. But yeah, no, he's fantastic in the show. And on the subject of Dwight is that apparently Laura Manel from Alphas, and who has guest starred in the most recent few episodes of Haven, will continue to appear in the second half of the season in 2015, along with the other wrestler whose name I'm really cool up, Jay Rizzo, who's also known as WWE superstar Christian Cage. There's a few new and returning characters who will be appearing in the show when it comes back next year for what I'm kind of hoping is it's fun.
Yeah.
It needs based to on come the way that the current season. Yeah, it needs to come to a conclusion. It needed to come to a conclusion this year, but Siffy decided to stretch it out.
Yes.
And they wonder why we're annoyed with them.
Yeah, it would just be the latest in a string of reasons, I imagine, among many of the people in the audience. And finally, the last one that we're going to cover this time around, Edmund, I think that you'll take this one and enjoy it.
Absolutely. Seems to be my week for announcing premiere dates. This time over on the shows we're most interested in are the FX premieres. Archer is returning for its 6th season in early January, January 8th. So we know our Vogue compatriot Travis Donovan of Under Sedation will have that date circled on his calendar. And for me, of course, the Americans will be returning in late January, so I'm very, very thankful to FX for giving me that early notification of my birthday present from them. That is January 28th, returning in its usual Wednesday at 10 o'clock time slot. And also Justified will be returning for its 6th and final season on Tuesday the 20th. And that is a show that I have finally finally, after hearing both on the podcast here and various friends how good it is, I have been making my way through the first season, so I now have a target date to try and get caught up. And since it looks like we're going to be entering some pretty major holiday hiatuses with the shows we cover for the podcast, I think there is a chance I might even be able to do that, thanks to that shorter cable season. The FX is really going to have a jam-packed January. I think this might be an attempt to sort of counter-program against some of the holiday downtime. American Horror Story Freak Show will be returning for its final three episodes in early January. I think it's January 7th, they said. And, of course, given American Horror Story's penchant in previous seasons, we will have to see how much of a good thing that is or isn't. But I am sure we'll be hearing all about that over on the website.
I'm sure we will. All right, well, that being said, we're going to go ahead and move into our break and then follow that up with more episodic discussion, so stay tuned.
Are you coming to the tree? They strung up a man, they say, who murdered three. Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree where a dead man called out for his love to flee? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree where I told you to run so we'd both be free? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree where a necklace of hope side by side with me? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree where I told you to run so we'd both be free? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree? They strung up a man, they say we were free. Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met and live in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree?
I can say is that if we don't get into this episodic discussion soon, it's going to be simply inhuman. So we should probably jump right on in. And let's go ahead then and continue with the shows that we said were at the top of our list collectively. And not surprisingly, one of those has turned out to be a couple episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Guild. Two of them were on our list this time around. Both of them got fairly high scores. Let's start with the first one. Here's the promo.
In 2 weeks, the Coulson mystery is on the verge of being solved.
There's just a few pieces missing. It's almost there.
But the solution might tear them apart.
Don't make me use this.
On a new Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And next Tuesday, celebrate the pop culture powerhouse that is Marvel with special guests and exclusive sneak peeks.
The Marvel Universe conquered the planet.
Emily Van Camp hosts Marvel, 75 years from pulp to pop, a brand new special next Tuesday, 9, 8 central on ABC.
All right, and Edmund, why don't you do the recap for this?
Certainly. This is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 2, Episode 7, The Writing on the Wall. Bodies with alien writing are found, and these symbols resemble Coulson's etchings.
Yes, indeed. And this got a collective average of 8.5, which, by the way, is effectively what the season so far is getting as an average. Which is rather shocking, considering how it seemed like the first season was struggling to get some degree of consistency. But this season has been really just ramping it up. I see here that we were anywhere from an 8 to a 9. I gave it a 9, of course, and you can read my thoughts on this one over at the website, bognetwork.com. But Edmund, why don't you get us started? And then Bronstam, I know you came in at an 8, so it wasn't too far afield, but follow up when Edmund is done, if you don't mind.
With this one, I liked the way they introduced this element of a new person who or a new villain who has also been affected with by the alien injections and feeling this compulsion to carve, but going in that much darker vein of actually doing it on people as opposed to just abusing sheetrock the way Coulson has been doing, and I thought that was a very effective way of ramping up both the extremes to which people will go, and also, I mean, as John was just saying, compared to the way things just were dragging along until they could get to the Winter Soldier tie-in last season, just the way they are just facing all of these issues head on with Coulson. Yes, he did keep it secret for a while, but then did bring everybody into the loop, and also being very upfront about, you know, we've all been injected with it. It's affecting me this way. It's affecting this guy that way, and also, but you know, but actually addressing, you know, what is or isn't happening with Sky, and not trying to skirt around that issue, but addressing it directly, and yeah, I just thought it did a very effective job of just continuing this to advance their plot lines without things really lagging, and which I think would be the main reason why this season is really picking up compared to what we went through last season, even though we certainly collectively were not as down on the show as some people were, but it just really feels like they're now they've been able to get past that. They're really doing a good job of just bringing everything forward.
Bronson, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much I can add to that. The main reason that I marked it down a little bit, I think, compared to some of the others, is that I had a bit of trouble with some of the guest cast. It just sort of threw me off, and I'm not sure it's because they had some slightly wonky performances, or if it was just the sudden name recognition of goodness, Coulson's interrogating an NTAC agent and Courtney Cox's ex. Don't ask. Yeah, but they, I don't know. Some of those performances didn't quite gel for me, and they took me a little bit out of the action, and it was just sort of those bits at the end that brought me back in a bit. It was still a strong episode. It still pushed the plot forward a lot. I guess I just didn't get as much out of it as others did, or as much as I would get out of the next episode.
Gary, what would you follow that up with?
Well, I wanted to just go back for a second. You know, we're talking about, I was a little surprised that how many other people had the procedure that Coulson had. Well, I guess I was naive to assume it hadn't been tested or used before, you know, to have this whole concept that four other people had that happen to them. And in some cases, they didn't quite react as strongly as Coulson has. Was also sort of interesting. Like, everybody sort of is advancing at different rates as far as this, you know, compulsion over this. But so, you know, that whole opening up even more of what happened to Coulson was surprising. I thought it had sort of been, you know, done and put to bed. So it was nice to get even more background on this whole procedure coming up. Also, I have to say, we didn't talk about it much so far, but I'm really enjoying the Ward subplot, or, you know, B plot, if you want to call it, or even C plot, I guess, maybe. But I'm really enjoying it a lot. They're still keeping him in so many ways ambiguous as to his true motivations that makes me want to, you know, it's keeping me interested in his storyline besides some of these more major goings-ons.
Hmm. Yeah, I would say that surprisingly Ward's subplot is really working for me, even though I feel like it's the, while it's not the most prominent thing, at least not in this episode, it is a nice reflection or takeaway to the main action that's going on. So it's a good complete episode. Even as they continue to throw open the doors, so to speak, on how all these things are starting to connect. And speaking of that, we have the next episode here, and here's the promo for that one.
My job now is to keep an eye on the big picture.
And he found something to chase.
ABC next Tuesday.
It won't just kill. It will do something much cooler.
An object so valuable.
We can find out if this exists once and for all.
Their mission to track it.
We don't. Hydra will. We need to get there first.
Could cost.
Know your enemy.
An agent's.
This doesn't feel right.
Life.
Down, ambush!
New Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Next Tuesday at 9, 8 central on ABC.
All right, Nedmund, if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 2, Episode 8, The Things We Bury. The team race against Hydra to uncover an ancient secret. Meanwhile, Ward abducts his brother in order to brutally reflect on their past.
Yes, and this episode has the highest score so far this season, and definitely in that upper tier at a 9.1. That's pretty darn good on our score. So, Gary, why don't you get us started on this one? What was the thing that you found that really took this one to the next level?
The fanaticism of Ward helped with his brother. As they're talking between themselves, I had the sense that most of Ward's pretense was gone, and in some ways we were getting the truth, the real truth out of him for a change. And I, you know, so I found that interesting. The fact that we've finally discovered what all this obsession and drawing was about was a relief. I wasn't sure how much longer we were going to go on with this, and it had gotten a little long in the tooth for me. So I was glad we finally found out that, you know, it's this hidden city that has to be found, and we're moving forward. I was a little surprised how quickly the compulsion goes away as soon as you find out it's a city. It seemed too cookie cutter for me, but as I said, it's been growing long in the tooth for me, so I'm glad that bit of it's passed. Also, I guess we can start using this blood again, and just as soon as the people wake up, tell them it's a city and they won't go crazy anymore. So definitely a useful medical application at this point too.
Bronstone, what would you add to that?
Not sure.
Okay.
Sorry. My connection's been cutting in and out a little bit.
Okay. Typical, thanks to Australia. But how about you, Edmund? Anything you want to add to what Gary had to say? I think we all are in high agreement to just how much the writers brought to this one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really everybody did.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, I just wanted to circle back just momentarily. I mean, one thing I did really like in the previous episode was the way they did the reveal of the city and the fact it was a blueprint, and that final piece of the puzzle in terms of these different ways that it's been affecting people. And of course, it's the guy who goes three-dimensional and incorporating it into the train set so that to finally click it home that, you know, no, this is a blueprint. This is a city that we're looking for. I thought was very nicely done. And with this episode, I mean, it was the number of elements that they were introducing and advancing each of them really, really well. So I was talking about just in terms of the way they were working with the writing plot in the previous episode, but then in this episode, the Ward and his brother interactions and still keeping you on the edge of your seat over which of these guys is really the master manipulator, they are both extremely gray, but I thought that it was very nicely done the way they kept whipsawing us back and forth over which one was more evil, basically. And then of course, I mean, the other highlight of this was Agent Carter making her brief appearance as our introduction to seeing Whitehall's de-aging process. It certainly gave Reed Diamond a very nice showcase to give us the background on that character and also the background on the obelisk. That all worked really, really well. I thought.
Not just the background on the obelisk or Whitehall, but in essence, the background on Sky,
yes.
Finally.
Yeah.
I mean, it all fell together in this episode, which is what I thought was so remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly, I mean, that nice little reveal of Dyken Lockman's character, I can't remember the character's name, but of her reappearing in the past as herself, basically. So I thought all of that was very nicely done. They're really escalating things, and I think just ramping it up very nicely I haven't been checking the schedule, but I assume they're going to be going on hiatus, so we're coming up to a fall finale, since everybody seems to have a fall finale now.
Indeed they are.
Yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, I guess anything that you want to bring up, Bronstone, to kind of add to this?
This episode was, it delivered tons of exposition in ways that were very engaging. That's a real skill for any kind of TV show, for any kind of writing. We learned tons about Whitehall. We learned bits about the early days of S.H.I.E.L.D. with that Agent Carter flashback. We learned a lot more about the mythology of the Marvel universe as it relates to all these characters. The audience is really ahead of the characters at this point. I mean, by the time that episode's over, I think a lot of the people who are even vaguely familiar with the Marvel universe have drawn a pretty good conclusion as to some of the things going on, which John threw in a really, really terrible pun about at the top of the hour. even I'm not that familiar with certain aspects of the Marvel Universe, and I drew this conclusion it's setting the stage for something really, really interesting and engaging. It's done something that good episodes like this do, is it's made me want to go back and rewatch episodes, bits and pieces of the show as it's aired so far to really see how much things track, because now I'm looking at things that have happened in a different light. It had me top to tail. I wasn't expecting a Peggy Carter cameo. I wasn't expecting some of the connections that were made. But yeah, it was thoroughly entertaining. It was one of the best episodes of the season, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And the numbers obviously bear that out. Not the ratings, unfortunately, which are still struggling. My only hope is that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is so strong, and this being an offshoot of that, maybe there is a really low bar that it needs to pass over in order to keep on the air. But I don't understand why the ratings are so low at this point. The show has really turned around and has become easily one of the best things on TV right now, and I don't know what the problem is. But anyway, let's go ahead then and move on to a show that does nothing, it seems, but improve, which maybe they're trying to go out on top, and that would be The Newsroom. Yes, the last of the shows that were up at the top of our list. And again, we have two episodes to go through here, so let's go ahead with the first promo.
We're a team here. We're a family. But just to be clear, he's the one who did it.
A PR company killed 38 people. We do nothing, and the 39th is on us.
Good afternoon, Leona.
We own this for friends and family. If you're trying to poach my company, I prefer Mrs. Lansing.
You've committed espionage. The FBI will take you in for questioning and not let you go until you reveal your source.
All right, and Gary, why don't you go ahead with this recap?
Absolutely. We're talking about The Newsroom, Season 3, Episode 2, Run. Rebecca defends ACN again against another lawsuit looming. Meanwhile, Neil could be in trouble after a dangerous leak that affects national security. Charlie and Leona confront a hostile takeover attempts by Reese's two half-siblings. Sloan, meanwhile, worries that Don has crossed an ethical line, while Haley regrets a late-night tweet. Maggie also weighs the pros and cons of eavesdropping in on other people's conversations.
Yes, and this one had a score of 9.3, which I believe is the highest scored episode of The Newsroom since its inception. And, yeah, I think we all kind of love this one. I believe you gave this one a 10, Gary.
It was just, it was firing on all cylinders for me. I mean, we got, I'd say, the entire cast in with significant dialogue or contributions to the episode. It really worked well. I particularly enjoyed the whole Neil plot, as well as the, I won't call it a solution, but the whole menu planning issue, which at first I wasn't quite sure where the heck that was going, but it was so brilliantly played at the end, owing to the title of this episode, Run, which was what was Will had written in the menu to Neil. And so, sort of from inception to conclusion, it tightened up well as the lovely little plot with Maggie as she's sitting on that train listening to the EPA official go through stuff and realize that, she has to do the right thing. I was very happy to see this, as we've commented, or at least I've mentioned, how broken she was as a character. To see this, makes me really feel like she's healed, might not be the right word, but definitely grown and come back from the point where she was at. She's much more confident, capable, and to make not only good decisions, but wise ones. So it just worked really well. The whole Leona sort of subplot about, ACN being sold out from under was, cute novel, and it got to involve, several of the characters that we've come to like. As we see these shows sort of come to an end, sometimes you'll get these sort of obligatory homages as characters are, literally pulled in for almost no reason, just to give them a few moments of airtime. But in this case, it felt very natural, and worked quite well. Jane Fonda's scenes were particularly enjoyable, and I don't particularly enjoy her. So, again, another part where this episode really won for me. Did you guys have any strong points that that maybe I haven't mentioned that you found?
Well, I just wanted to mention that Sorkin sort of made that whole walking and talking motif a whole meme of its own on The West Wing, and what really amazed me, as I was mentioning at the top of our last episode, was so much of this episode was people just sitting around a conference table or sitting on a train or sitting in an office just talking to each other, but it was all riveting, and that whole back and forth with Reese and the siblings and Charlie coming in and trying to sweet talk them, and then Leona coming in and sort of hardballing them. And then the whole back and forth with Mac, basically, trying to get the scoop from her FBI friend, and then the way that was all coming down with the raid and Will and Rebecca and Mac and Charlie having to trying to navigate that, and it was just to my mind, this was the sort of vintage Sorkin that has come through at times in this series, but I really feel like this was the episode where we were really getting it full force, and it was just wonderful to watch.
Yeah, you couldn't take your eyes off it, right? And like you said, even though nothing huge was going on in terms of action, it was just the suspense of the situation. Bronstein, what would you add to this particular one? I know you didn't give it a 10, but a 9 still is pretty high.
Yeah, it was incredibly strong. It was you said it. The word is riveting. It was a great example of Sorkin's roots in the theater, and how much good content you can get by just strong personalities played by strong actors really just sitting down and butting heads with one another, tossing some really, really good dialogue and some really compelling context, and you just get some fantastic stuff going on. I love the stuff with Reese and Charlie and the two younger siblings, and then Jane Fonda just comes at the end and owns everyone. That was phenomenal, and I just love the way it all the way it all built. I love the discussion of Neil Singh, and it really felt like Sorkin was trying to get back to recapture some bits and pieces of the original ethos of the show, which was to explore in a positive idealistic way the concept of journalism, like what it should be about, what lines are there and that should or shouldn't be crossed and stuff like that. And we get the discussion with what Neil did, and we get the what happens with what Maggie did, and just the idea of Sorkin's continuing to try and present an industry that's not very well liked by a lot of people, that there are positive idealistic examples to be found, even if we kind of have to make them up, in the hope that you know, it might inspire some people to do a better job in the real world.
Yeah, the only thing that took a little bit away from this one for me, and it actually carries over into the next one as well, is that I feel like in order to get his point across in the fact that there is a certain amount of Sorkin's own ideology falling into this as far as his political thoughts are concerned, Neil is really being a bit of an idiot. And quite frankly, it's almost like it's catching throughout the episode, because there's a certain point at which you just have to stop making things worse, and people just keep making things worse. There is that idealism in there too, but it's almost as if Sorkin's trying to say, well, the thing that they're doing is so right that it's worth doing all of the, you know, doing time and risking everything to make sure that this leak is allowed to happen. And I don't know. It's one of those things where I kind of wish he was being a little more balanced on that, but it's Sorkin. So I kind of get past that relatively quickly. So that leads us into, I think, the next episode, and here's a promo for that one.
Do you know where Neil Sampat is?
What are my rights in this situation?
Stand away from your desk.
Gone, Jim. Power up our control room. Gary, grab the camera.
Charlie. Randy and Blair have to be stopped from selling the shares.
This is the new HR rep.
Wyatt thinks we're dating.
And I'm going to nail you.
Did Mr. Sampat tell you the name of the source?
Yes.
Will you tell us the source?
No.
But you got a problem.
All right, and Gary, if you could do the recap yet again.
Absolutely. We're still talking about The Newsroom, Season 3, Episode 3, Main Justice. Leona and Reese scramble to raise money to halt Blair's and Randy's attempted takeover of ACN. Meanwhile, Charlie shares ideas with an ACN suitor. Meanwhile, Maggie's scoop on the EPA gets airtime on Newsnight. Sloan and Don also try to keep their romance a secret from the new HR executive who's trying to have one of them transferred. And finally, Will is in for a surprise at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Yes, and this one dialed back a little bit from the previous episode with an average score of 8.6, so still well above average, but not quite in the over 9 range, which is where the truly elite episodes might be. Everybody kind of came back to at least a point, except for me. I was still at a 9, but again, I was not at quite the heights that some people took the last episode. So I'm curious, Gary, what was missing from this episode?
A few things. Number one, and maybe this is how it is in the real world, I just have a hard time picturing it. There's sort of Will's sort of cavalier attitude towards this whole, I don't know if you want to call it spying, if you want to call it treason. I'm not sure, you know, what you want to call what Neil did to get access to this confidential information. But Will is taking it almost too cavalier for me. I'm not saying that he has to, you know, pull his blanket over his head and hide somewhere in a corner, but at the same time, his complete, you know, shooting from the hip disrespect is, while it's very nice for Will to come off with cute little, you know, idioms and stuff, it seemed a little too relaxed. I felt like there needed to be, you know, some higher degree of tension than there actually was. Other characters seem to be exhibiting it, but not Will at all, and it just seemed like a blind spot for me. And secondly, I have to admit, the whole Sloan and Don hiding their relationship, given the weight of some of the other things going on, such as, you know, ACM getting sold off, as well as this whole investigation, seemed almost out of place or farcical in relation. It just was so far off scope that it seemed out of place.
Yeah, I think that's what I was alluding to, was that it's like, okay, it was bad enough that they decided to side with Neil so strongly when there is a very legal argument to be made that he screwed up royally. For them to be so confident that nothing was going to come of it, and then even when it was becoming even more clear that it was actually going to be taken very seriously, for Will to be sitting there almost like mocking the guy was like, yeah, it's bad enough that you're defending this and pretending that nothing is wrong with it, but then to act like such an arrogant ass about it doesn't help. That being said, it was some of the most watchable arrogance I've seen.
Oh, it was fun. I'm not saying it wasn't fun. It just seems out of place.
Oh, it did. And that's my one argument against the whole thing, is that it's like that's Sorkin kind of pushing his own thoughts, I think, because I can't imagine that Mr., you know, even moderate Republican Will is going to be so cavalier about the idea of treason. Which, I mean, by all definitions, Neil did completely blow this one. So, you know, it's kind of hard to not... I would be treading a lot more lightly, let's put it that way. Yeah. Ron Stock, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it did have that problem of... you've got to... The show is essentially trying to... the show is trying to defend the actions of a character who has done the wrong thing in the worst way in the name of... But for a good reason. Thinking about it now, I almost think this is like... this is Sorkin trying to do what the previous season was supposed to be about, but do it the right way. One of my complaints about season two was that this overarching story of the Genoa thing was that they kind of framed it as this is the Newsnight team, they dropped the ball, they made a mistake, they did it the wrong way, and then the show kind of copped out at the end by saying no, it was this one guy who came in who was actually kind of a bit more of an amoral guy, and it was all his fault. It always rankled me the wrong way, and here we have we have a similar sort of storyline, but with no weaseling out. There's a no. This is pretty clearly the actions of the someone in the Newsnight team, and the rest of the, you know, other people in the team are perhaps going to get getting themselves stuck in the mud in their attempt to defend him. And as much as I think Neil has, you know, he has good intentions. He's trying to do something good. It's just like, yeah, they're all sticking their muck in it. It's more interesting. Yeah. It's more dramatic than in a way that the previous season wasn't. And I appreciate that. But then you have the, like you said before, the Don and Sloan storyline really stuck out like a sore thumb. It almost feels like the show is not quite sure what to do with them, with regard to the, it's not quite sure how to make them part of the main storyline of the season.
I will say this, in agreement with what you're saying, having Neil do this also makes a lot more sense, because of all the people on the staff, he seems like the one who would overreach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's young. He's young. He's very idealistic. He's from the sounds of things in that first season episode where he's talking about his background, he came into journalism in a slightly different way to a lot of the other people, and he has a completely different set of values when it comes to this one aspect. Like, he's the person who's very tapped into the all the online stuff. You know, he was the one with interested in WikiLeaks, who was interested in Occupy Wall Street and stuff like that. He has a very different perspective on a lot of those things. He's the one with a perspective that's just far enough to the side of where everyone else is to not only get involved in this kind of storyline, but to make this kind of mistake.
Mm-hmm. Evan, what would you add to all this?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with your analysis of Will's role in all this, because I saw where he was where Sorkin was trying to introduce this element of hubris kind of back into Will's character, and certainly that whole ending of, you know, maybe I'm not as big a TV star as I thought. But you know, I think those attitudes would have made more sense in the previous episode when they were getting these signals that, oh no, nobody's been prosecuted, no journalist's been prosecuted, it's not going to be that serious. But then it was certainly obvious by the end of the episode and then the beginning of this one where they're having to do this brinksmanship with a faked live broadcast, that no, they had misread the situation, and this idea of Will saying oh no, I'll just take it all on myself because I'm such a big name, they won't really go after me, seemed like just stretching Will's naivete too far, and and certainly with the Sloan and Don thing, I think what's getting to me more, I mean, I was getting a little uncomfortable with the way they were playing this sort of standard trope of, oh, we're both commitment phobes and we're just going to be coy about, are we a couple, are we not a couple? But then to throw in the HR guy as well, was just really going over the top with it. And if he just kept it more low key and in the background and sort of a little kind of nice sort of screwball comedy nod to His Girl Friday motif in the background, it would be fine. But injecting this another conflict revolving around the office was just not quite sitting well with me. I guess the one thing in that preview, or one of the things we haven't really talked about, was certainly having Maggie's EPA, whatever he is, the deputy director, since they don't have a director, come on the air and finally be the guy who just says, yes, we're all going to die thanks to global warming. Was typical Sorkin hyperbole, but I still did find that refreshing.
It was so dry in the comedic way that it was being presented, because it didn't get to the point of hilarity because of the just so doom laden that it was, and the deadpan way that he was going across it really didn't step over the line until the very end, where it's like, oh yeah, if we get all the scientists on it and they all really try really hard, yeah, we're all still gonna die. Yes. I just started laughing at that because it was just so, you could just tell that everyone's like, wait, what? This guy's one of them? Oh, great. But it's that was a nice bit of absurdity to maybe counteract Will and his extreme hubris in this episode. What I will say too is that I feel like the whole thing with Sloan, maybe it feels to me like they're really piling on all the reasons why the Newsnight is going to come to an end. And I think that maybe this is just another one of those things that's going to be on the list. And it's just all these things that are going to, that they might be able to handle all, you know, separately, with it happening all at once. It's just going to tank them, and they're all going to wind up, it's going to come crashing down, which unfortunately goes a bit against that kind of semi-finale that the second season ended on with such, yes, happiness, yes, but maybe more fitting for a Sorkin show about the state of the news today. So. Any last thoughts on the newsroom, Gary?
No, I like it. It's such a nice, tight story. At first I regretted this short number of episodes we were getting, but if they're cutting out pretty much all the fluff filler and just extra minor storylines that would normally get thrown in, and we're ending up with a very strong season, in my opinion. So.
Yeah. Bronstam, how about you? Any last thoughts?
Yeah, I've really been enjoying the season. It's a lot tighter than the previous one. It's more, for the most part, more on topic. Built in more ambiguity and stuff like that, and at the same time it gets back to the idealism and the finding their way aspect of the first season. It's been great. I'm gonna be really upset when the show finishes, unless they, you know, chuck in a real stinker in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, Edmund, any last thoughts on this one?
I'll just reiterate that it's nice to see a show that has one of these truncated final seasons really marching through the story, unlike say some of the sci-fi offerings of recent years. And you also got me thinking, mentioning last season's finale, that we know that Sorkin does love things Shakespearean, so it's really up in the air now whether we're going to end on the traditional comedic note of a wedding or the tragic note of everybody dying.
Exactly. All right, well, I thought we were going to get to the shows that were at the bottom of our list this time around, but I guess we're going to have to pick that up next show. So we'll wrap it up here, and we'll close out the week next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth. on Twitter at Critical Myth or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.